Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to How Should I Be Positioned on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. On this podcast, we like to exchange macro and market views with our industry colleagues and thought leaders, along with thinking when it comes to asset allocation. With that, joining us as we're making our way through the blizzard of 2026, we're not in studio today. We are doing this remote, though we're very happy to have back on the podcast with us Torsten Slok, partner and chief economist at Apollo Global Management. We're joined today, as always, from the UBS Chief Investment Office as well by Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas, Jason Draho. So with that, Torsten, Jason, thank you as always for dedicating some time to be with our listeners, our clients here on How Should I Be Positioned. I know there is a lot of topics we want to get through today. So Jason, let me turn it over to you to lead the conversation with Torsten.
All right. Well, thank you, Dan. And thank you, Torsten, for joining us under suboptimal weather conditions. It is still, the blizzard is still kind of going on as we record this in New York City. Definitely not hot. But I got the kind of the flip side of the first question I wanted to discuss was, you know, the consensus narrative starting last fall for the markets was that we're in this sort of run and hot environment, and that the idea that growth is going to accelerate, it's going to, you know, benefit from stimulus measures and policies that were enacted last year, and that we would see growth surge in the first half of 2026. You know, the data coming in looks sort of consistent with that, I think, but it's also really noisy because we're still dealing with a kind of a backlog of data that was delayed because of the government shutdown last fall. When you look at the state of the economy right now, do you think that narrative from a macro perspective is justified? Is the data coming in that way? Do you still have confidence in that? Or do you think maybe we need to kind of recalibrate the thesis?
No, I do think still that there's a number of tailwinds to the U.S. economic outlook that continue to play out in the background. First of all, last year we had the AI spending boom continuing into 2026, and that spending boom, of course, continues to provide a tailwind, especially to the data center build-out, also to the associated energy build-out. Secondly, we also still have an industrial renaissance. There's a political will and strong opinion that we should homeshore or onshore several things that used to be produced abroad, most importantly semiconductors, pharmaceuticals, also defense. And this industrial renaissance continues to also be a very important tailwind to growth at the moment. And lastly, we also have the One Big Beautiful Bill that took effect here on January the 1st. And that will mean that households that normally get around $3,000 in tax refunds in March and April, they will now this year get $4,000 in refunds. Because remember, the One Big Beautiful Bill was done retroactively. And that means it starts instead on January the 1st, 2025. So the consequence, of course, of that is that we have all been paying too much in taxes in 2025. In other words, withholdings have been too high. And as a result of that, again, households will get on average about $1,000 more. And given that's about 130 million households in the U.S., that brings you into many billions of dollars of consumer spending that is likely going to come out over the next several months. So the short answer, Jason, to your question is there's a number of structural tailwinds. Importantly, tailwinds that are not a function of what the Fed funds rate is, but tailwinds that mainly are the AI and data center build-out and the industrial renaissance and the One Big Beautiful Bill. And those are reasons why we should continue to be optimistic on the growth outlook as we go through 2026.
So you mentioned a few different things, and I want to come back to them in terms of kind of the question of, you know, if we're going to be wrong, like which of those factors might be most wrong. But there's a kind of a third or even a fourth kind of wild card that's been thrown into the mix just in the past few days regarding tariffs. You know, last time I think we did a podcast, it was in the summer of 2025. Already then, the market felt like they're kind of moving on from tariffs as the main story. And certainly, other than, you know, wondering when the Supreme Court's going to rule on the IEEPA tariffs, it's not been a factor really in market discourse so far this year. Given the initial reaction of the Supreme Court striking down the IEEPA tariffs, and then very quickly by Saturday morning, President Trump has signed an executive order implementing effective, I think it's midnight essentially, or just past midnight on the 24th of February, a 15% tariff kind of across the board on all goods imported to the U.S., which will likely expire by July 24th. The question I guess I have on that topic specifically is, how much do you think, if at all, do you think is this a headwind for the growth thesis that you laid out? Because ultimately, like, it still felt like the effective tariff rate is going to be lower all sequel than it would have been as of just a week ago. But does throw like a lot of uncertainty in existing trade deals for businesses that maybe thought they had some clarity, now they have to kind of rethink about it. how this is going to play out. So how much of a drag do you think, if at all, is this latest development on the tariff story altering your thoughts on the near or medium term for the U.S. economy?
Yeah, that's important, Jason. If we go back and look at what was the level of the average effective tariff rate, meaning what was the average tax that was imposed on imports, what was it before the Supreme Court decision? And that was, according to the Yale Budget Lab, around 16%. When the Supreme Court then struck down the IEEPA tariffs, then that moved down to 9%. And then Trump, of course, here has added now 15% back on top of that. That brings us back that the average effective tariff rate is now moving from 9 to 14. So that means that effectively where we are today at an average effective tariff rate at 14% is basically not too far away from the 16% that we were at before the Supreme Court decision. So from that perspective, it is not much different. And in that sense, to your question, the impact on the economy is probably going to be relatively modest. If anything, tariffs are going to drop a little bit from 16 to 14. And that, of course, should be positive for growth. And that should also mean that downward pressure, modestly at least, on inflation. What really is, exactly as you're highlighting, the key challenge now is that we have now, unfortunately, a new uncertainty appearing on the horizon, namely that the Section 122 tariffs that were imposed by Trump, the 15%, they will only be allowed to stand for 150 days. And after that, they will need congressional approval. So that means that in about 6 months' time, which means just before the midterm election, now Congress needs them to decide whether they're going to continue the 15% tariff on the rest of the world or whether they're going to say, no, we're going to take this away and then lower the effective tariff rate to 9%. The issue also is that the IEEPA tariffs allowed, of course, Trump to put tariffs on individual countries. Section 122 is for all countries that are importing, I mean, that the U.S. is importing from. So that makes also a very big difference that it's no longer possible to the same degree for the president to impose tariffs on individual countries, whereas the 122 section is all about 15% on all countries at the same time. But from a macroeconomic perspective, you're right, this creates some new uncertainty about what will happen in 150 days. What does this mean now that it suddenly is all countries? And it is correct what you're saying, and I agree with that, namely that given that elevated level of uncertainty, that is a very, very modest headwind, at least here and now. But I still think that headwind is relatively small compared to the strong tailwinds that I mentioned, namely AI spending, the industrial renaissance, and the One Big Beautiful Bill.
So on those factors, and look, I think we're on the same page in that if the direction of travel for the U.S. economy was to accelerate from here, maybe this tariff news alters the slope a little bit, maybe slightly lower, maybe slightly higher, but it doesn't really change the general trajectory. So there's not a risk that their growth could not maybe materialize. And you alluded to the one big bill, the stimulus. And I guess the question that everyone's sort of tracking right now is the refunds tracking ahead to suggest this will happen? Or in general, could the stimulus from that bill not be as much as people think? The industrial renaissance argument you made, like again, the construction, that's true, but will it actually matter so much in the near term? Other factors that could be in play is the labor market, a lot of questions regarding, will job growth actually accelerate, especially given companies may be anxious about the economy, anxious about should they be trying to deploy AI instead. And so would hiring stay low, in which case you start to wonder, will it start to weigh on consumer sentiment if they're worried about, keeping or not even getting a new job. So when you think of all the different drivers that you laid out for why growth would accelerate, including add on the labor market for the story getting better, what would be all these factors, what's one that you think is the biggest risk of not materializing, or if it does materialize or doesn't materialize, would be the biggest drag on the growth thesis?
Yeah, this is very important because let's take the two things, namely the labor market and AI, because you're right that the labor market has indeed shown that job growth has been slower. A lot of attention is being paid to the slowdown in job growth last year relative to 2024. But a very, very important reason for that is simply that there was a very significant decline in immigration. For the years 2022, 23, and 24, net immigration into the U.S., both legal and illegal, was about 3 million people came into the country on average for those 3 years. Then when Trump entered, of course, as president, starting, of course, early 2025, last year and this year, on average, net immigration will drop from around 3 million for those years to now around 500,000. And the consequence, of course, of this is that job growth should also be slowing down. The Brookings Institute has been calculating that in the years 2022, 2023, and 2024, non-farm payrolls on average was around 200,000. And now the break-even rate, because of immigration declining so much, according to the Dallas Fed, is only around 30,000. So that's a very dramatic decline in job growth, simply because we have fewer immigrants coming into the country. And that is important, because also when people begin to talk about, well, what has AI done to the labor market, or what has the trade war done to the labor market, well, that then needs to also take into account that those effects need to be calculated, while at the same time recognizing that immigration has dropped as dramatically as it has. So the first conclusion, in my view, is I still think the key reason why the labor market has shown slower job growth is by far because of the decline in the labor supply, and not so much because of the decline in labor demand. If you look at the private sector, labor demand has been relatively steady at around 1% growth in jobs year over year throughout the last 18 months. So the first conclusion is I think the labor market is better than its reputation, simply because it is mainly labor supply that has driven things down. And on AI, I think still it's very early, as Jay Powell has been saying at several press conferences when he's been asked about this. He still says, and I agree with that, that there is no sign of AI today in the labor market. There's no sign today of AI in inflation. There's no sign today of AI in productivity. Perhaps most importantly, if you look at earnings expectations to the Magnificent Seven over the last year, the Magnificent Seven earnings expectations have gone up a lot. But if you then, over the same period, compare that with earnings expectations for the S&P 493, they have basically moved sideways. So that's a different way of saying if AI really were such a revolutionary technology, you should also expect that to show up in higher profitability in the S&P 493. But that's simply not what the market is expecting. So I still think the jury is out in terms of what AI will do. And at this point, it's just clear, at least in the data that we look at, that there's just not signs yet of AI showing up in the data.
Well, we'll come back to the AI question later on, because it is not so much in the near term, I think, a driver, other than perhaps the hyperscalers, the amount of CapEx they're going to spend to be a driver for just investment this year, therefore GDP growth. But structurally, there's just some important questions that I want to come back to. But speaking a little bit with the more cyclical outlook, we are, only 10 plus minutes into this podcast. We've talked about growth, we talked about the drivers, fiscal policy, tariff policy. We have not yet talked about inflation. And the biggest concern when tariffs are first introduced is that it'd be inflationary. And that's not necessarily, but it's evident in the data, but we have not seen a massive inflation surge. And when you start to look at the components of inflation, it still looks like disinflation trends are at work. Like the shelter piece looks like it's going to continue to go lower. Goods ultimately should sort of roll over in terms of inflation once the tariff shock, kind of fully works its way through. But I think the risk, of course, is that we're a little too complacent on this. The run-out hot narrative implies that, we almost have overheating in the economy, which would mean typically inflation stays elevated. So how confident are you right now that inflation will actually roll over, and by year end, it's trending towards 2% comfortably? It's not going to get stuck closer to 3%.
Yeah, this is very important. We just got also recently the latest data for PCE inflation, which is the measure of inflation that the Fed is watching most carefully. And it did, unfortunately, move up to 3% year over year. So if you look at a chart for headline PCE inflation, for core PCE inflation, even for supercore PCE inflation, it comes to the very clear conclusion that those pictures tell you exactly the worry, namely that inflation is at the moment sticky at around 3%. In fact, for supercore, it's begun to move up back towards 4%. So I think this is the key reason why Jay Powell went out and recorded the video on a Sunday afternoon, because he is basically trying to tell us that they are worried, and the FOMC, at least the majority of FOMC members, are worried that they cannot cut interest rates when inflation is sticky at around 3%. And the last point on this is also, there is now an important paper that was written at the Peterson Institute by Adam Posen and Peter Orszag, which is saying that inflation by the end of the year may be as high as 4%. So I still think that the unfortunate thing for the Fed is that it's going to be very difficult for them to cut interest rates this year when inflation continues to be as steady at around 3% as it is at the moment.
Well, picking up on the last point regarding the Fed, market pricing is still for two cuts this year. The next one's not fully priced until June, which is when Kevin Warsh, the nominee, presumably will be in office, assuming he gets through the regular confirmation process. And question was if that's going to happen or not, but let's take that at face value that that's going to ultimately work its way through, even if the timing is a little bit lower or slower. And so a cut by June in his first meeting, another cut by year end, which, you know, maybe the economic conditions were warranted, although, you know, given where inflation is, it would perhaps suggest it isn't. If the labor market is holding up okay, you could argue that the Fed really doesn't need to be cutting rates. But I think part of the rationale is with Warsh, you know, that he's kind of made the case for cuts. One might think that in order to get the job, he had to say, yes, I want to cut. So, he's made the argument that AI is going to be disinflationary. That's the reason to cut and so on and so forth. So we can speculate on what exactly the Fed will do this year. But I guess my more interest is, what would a Warsh-led Fed look like? Like, what is the policy reaction function? You know, there's a lot of talk about him wanting to shrink the balance sheet. What do you think is sort of realistic from a policy framework that's different than just, you know, what the Fed is already doing? How could that shift maybe this year and more so, you know, next year? Like, what are things that you look for? And also in a way that might be kind of out of consensus for what the market is currently thinking.
I agree. This is an important issue. And the key question is, of course, whether Warsh 1.0 will be saying the same things when he is now Warsh 2.0. The key issue for him, of course, is that there are 12 voting members on the FOMC. And at the last FOMC meeting, 10 of these members said we should not cut interest rates. Two members said that we should cut interest rates. Well, if you now swap one of the 10 with, meaning Jay Powell with Kevin Warsh, maybe there will be three people saying that they should cut interest rates. But there will still be nine people saying that they should not cut interest rates. So in some sense, I think at least the starting point is that it's business as usual for him. He will be having a hard time to convince those members who just voted to not cut interest rates that interest rates should be going down, especially with inflation having moved up and especially with growth likely accelerating over the coming months. So that's why the challenge for Kevin Warsh will be that it's the 12 voting members that decide what should happen, and the chairman can have some views, but the other members can have their own views, and it will remains to be seen whether the other members are going to change their views or not. But at least where we stand right now, I do think that when he joins on May the 15th, and as you said, the first meeting is in June, I still think that the challenge for him is that he needs to really get the committee together. And if he goes out himself and says, I think interest rates should have gone down, and the majority of the committee says, no, we didn't think so, then, of course, the press conference is going to be awkward. So that's why it will be a challenging time for him and for the committee, given that these tensions are underneath their views at the moment.
Separate from rates is the balance sheet. You know, Warsh has been critical about the Fed going beyond its remit or over its skis in terms of how big its balance sheet should be. He seems to advocate a smaller balance sheet. At the same time, there's also, especially last week, discussions about a kind of deal or framework that the Fed has with the Treasury. And this kind of goes back to, I think, like 1951, kind of in the post-Second World War era. You know, right after that, the Fed actually engaged, and I don't know the details of it, was actually in conjunction with the Treasury, but to kind of have a cap of 2% on 10-year Treasuries. Inflation surged and it came down. It helped ultimately kind of to get the economy back on track as it sort of recovered from the Second World War. But the deal that was sort of struck in 1951 seemed to create sufficient independence for the Fed to manage its balance sheet sort of separate from the Treasury. Given Warsh's view on the balance sheet, given sort of, you know, questions about, like, could this, you know, the Treasury under Bessent, do you think that looks like, well, you know, the Fed's not going to do Operation Twist, for example, will just change the supply and of issuance leading more to bills, for example. It's not been the case for the first year or so with Bessent as Treasury Secretary. But now that you're going to have maybe greater meeting of the minds between the Bessent and Warsh, how, you know, like, I guess, what do you think is in scope for change, or what realistically might happen, and what sort of implications could that have for either the conduct of monetary policy or financial markets overall?
Yeah, this is potentially very important, because any agreement or any accord between the Fed and the Treasury, of course, will need to be studied very, very carefully, because what is the new idea and what is the goal with such an accord? What is it that's not working in the relationship that the Fed and the Treasury have today? At the moment, of course, the Fed is operating completely independently of the Treasury. But if the accord has the purpose of coordinating more, of course, there will begin to be risk of a steeper curve in rate markets, because the result might be that investors could begin to worry about whether fiscal policy is beginning to drive more of the decisions at the Fed. And that's, of course, a situation where Fed independence will be debated very heavily in market, namely, what does it mean that the Fed is independent? What would such an accord mean if the Treasury has some handle on what the Fed should be doing. What Kevin Walsh has been saying is that he wants to indeed, as you say, shrink the balance sheet and get them back to their core mission, namely of simply just doing monetary policy. At the same time, if you do shrink the balance sheet today, you run the risk, of course, that you will have scarce reserves, and that runs the risk of creating all kinds of challenges in money markets like we saw in September of 2019. So there's a number of things that make it difficult for Kevin Walsh to shrink the balance sheet the way that he's been talking about earlier. So that's also why I think he's more pragmatic. I think he's going to go in and say, well, the goal here is really to get the inflation to 2% and have full employment. And with that can likely be done with a balance sheet that is at least closer to where it is today as a share of GDP without having to shrink it dramatically, because that raises a whole host of other problems and challenges in financial markets if he were to make the balance sheet a lot smaller.
I want to pivot back to the AI discussion we were having earlier. And again, that was kind of more couched in the context of, is it impacting labor market or productivity right now, or even looking back last year as an explanation for what's going on with either. But ultimately, your AI, we know it's kind of a multi-year implication. So looking less cyclical and more secular, 3, 5, 10-year horizon, you know, we know that AI will have an impact. It's probably going to be, you know, it should enhance productivity. Otherwise, you know, it has very little value if it doesn't do that. But if you were to, like, lean in certain directions of, like, the impact being large or small, or the impact on the labor market, you know, the argument that, like, ultimately, like, any new technology, there'll be disruption in the labor market, but a chance to create more jobs and it loses. Like, how are you thinking about more on a multi-year perspective, like, you know, the impact of AI and where you feel more confident, like, this is likely to happen, this is maybe less likely to happen, given some of the discussions that are taking place right now?
Yeah, this is obviously a very, very important risk to any asset allocation decision at the moment, because if AI succeeds, it will have consequences. If AI disappoints, it will have consequences. But let's just agree up to this point that AI has at least not yet, as Jay Powell also repeatedly says, shown up in the data for employment, productivity, and inflation, and it's also not yet shown up in the aggregate for data for profitability and for earnings others outside of the tech sector. So in that sense, where we stand right now, a lot of the discussion around what AI will do remains very speculative. But the way I think about it is two ways. First of all, if we really think about what AI is, it is simply doing tasks better in our jobs. So this then boils down to the question, okay, so if I do in my job and you do in your job, say 10, 20 different tasks every day, if I can make 1, 2, 3 of these tasks more efficient by using AI, then of course I will be more productive. But the key issue here is that there are basically no jobs in the US economy that only has one task. Most jobs that have one task have already been automated a long, long time ago. So in that sense, it's difficult to see this dramatic increase in the unemployment rate that some people talk about, because there are no jobs in the US that only have one task. Even jobs as a paralegal, lawyer, someone who radiograph, who looks at x-rays, that's not just one task. There's a lot of other dimensions than simply the AI part of their jobs. So this whole idea that they can just be replaced by a computer, it just seems very far-fetched in my view. So that's why my view is that so far it has not shown much up in the actual data, and I'm also skeptical that it will show up in a significant way that some people have been suggesting. And the second element also of the AI discussion is the following. Think about, for example, when a company invents a new product. That product could, for example, be, say, Ozempic. Well, those who have Ozempic and have produced it, they, when they produced it, had some years where they have some pricing power, some monopoly profits, where they could squeeze some extra profits out and generate a lot of revenue. But what is the product today in AI? Well, the product is a large language model. But the large language model, there are many different large language models. There's Grok, there's Claude, there's ChatGPT, Perplexity, Gemini, and the users, it's really difficult to see the difference between these large language models. So for that reason, the price of the product today is likely going to go down to zero. So the value is not the product itself, as it was with Ozempic, but the value is instead the how the product is used, in other words, how AI is disseminated through the economy. And that remains the key issue, namely, will it be deployed? Will it be decimated? Will it actually generate those significant gains in productivity and significant gains in incomes that people are assuming? And again, at this point, we're just not seeing that yet. Yes, certainly in some parts of the economy, and coding in particular, computer science, we have seen some improvements. But in the aggregate, it still remains questionable that these significant effects that some people talk about are going to materialize.
Well, I think the area that I think most people agree with is that it's going to, you know, enhance some efficiencies, like operational efficiencies, but bring costs down, as you mentioned. You know, ultimately, these models are somewhat interchangeable, and you know, that's, you know, no matter of debate, but let's say they're all pretty similar for a lot of tasks, and competition to drive the cost lower. That means our ability to go out and sort of apply the services and these tools, you know, the costs go lower. And so in that kind of, you know, the context where in the past few weeks we've seen in the market, you know, equity, but it's covered in a fixed income, is, well, AI could just go and disrupt all sorts of business models because it can do things at so much lower cost. It doesn't necessarily expand your revenue with top line, but it does it much lower cost. So software, the sector was being hit, and then a week after that, we saw like insurance companies reacting, brokers, even logistics companies, you know, so there's been this almost shoot for us to ask questions later between like who are the kind of the winners of all this, who has the moat, and who is the volatile losers. One knock-on effect is that, yeah, in the debt markets, is a lot of debt was issued to pay for investments, especially like, you know, software companies, technology companies in the public markets, but even more so in kind of the private markets. And we've seen, you know, some high profile examples of where there's been some stress there. How worried are you about from a just kind of financial system stability, contagion, or just a drag on economic activity if this continues and suddenly maybe access to capital gets dried up, or there's just, you know, defaults that are picking up? Is that a, you know, significant risk in your mind, or still, you know, maybe a little bit overstated given the current, you know, fears in the marketplace regarding what AI is going to disrupt?
I do think that the software sector is certainly threatened by AI, but I also think that the software, in a similar way as we just talked about before, it is really, AI is able to change individual tasks and do tasks better. But the question is, if you and I have a small business and we have some software that run the business, either say the production or our customer relationship management, are we going to stop subscribing to the software we use today and then sit down and code and program new software for our business? It seems also a little bit difficult to see this happening both in the short and in the long run, because if we were to do that, then we would need to hire a lot of programmers and a lot of AI managers who could then instead install the software on our own computer that were written by AI rather than subscribing to the software that we were used to subscribe to. So the bottom line is, I still think that it will make a difference, but I also think that there are some sectors and certainly some parts of software that will be threatened. But I also think that this also becomes an issue of, well, what types of software is it then? And that, of course, is the hard homework to look under the hood of individual sectors, of course, in particular software, and see which part of the software sector is it that's going to get hurt. And that, of course, continues to be a major challenge for investors. At the moment, the entire software sector, of course, is selling off. And that may be, of course, the right trade if you are a fast money trader. But if you then begin to look 2-3 years down the road, then it seems very unlikely that all software companies will be going out of business. So that's just to say that stock selection or credit selection continues to be absolutely key when one thinks about what the consequences are of the new technology that is AI.
So we've covered AI, we've talked about, you know, the Fed's tariffs, growth outlook, and risks to the growth outlook. Are there things that we haven't touched on, whether it's factors, risks, geopolitics, the midterms, something that you think is important to kind of cover, that maybe investors in general are focused, you know, not enough on, they think about what would matter for the economic and investing outlook for the rest of the year?
Yep. So the way we look at things is that we are driving the ball down the fairway and we're going towards the flag and the hole. And for the most of 2024 and 25, our view was that there was a 90% chance that we would stay within the guardrails of staying on the fairway, and only a 10% chance that we would land out in the rough. But given the challenges with geopolitics, given the challenges with debt levels, not only in the US, but also in Germany and in Japan, given the challenges, again, with now a trade war potentially coming back, with elections around the world, then I think that the likelihood of landing the ball out in the rough and getting some tail risk has increased from 10% to 30%. So therefore, investors should begin to construct their portfolios in a way where, in our view, there should be more focus on non-AI exposure, because AI is already a significant part of the S&P 500. And with the hyperscalers issuing more debt, then AI is also becoming a more significant part of the public IG market. And finally, AI is also becoming a bigger part of venture capital. It used to be the venture capital was biotech and pharma and fintech and growth, but now venture capital, two-thirds, is also AI. So if I think about the pie chart for asset allocation, normally we would say, oh, I have debt, I have equity, those things are uncorrelated. But today that's no longer the case. Debt and equity are highly correlated, because equity is all AI in the S&P 500, and in credit, in public credit, it's also all AI. And finally, venture capital is also all AI. So I think investors, the best thing to do at the moment is to try to find some exposure to things that are not AI, meaning to things that are not exposed to the situation, either where AI is unsuccessful, but paradoxically also to the scenario where AI is widely successful.
Well, that actually kind of segues into a closing comment I'll make, that one of our messages, certainly with equities, is an idea of a great broadening. You know, the markets, the U.S. equity markets specifically, have been fairly concentrated, driven heavily by Mag 7 or some iteration of the Mag 7, if we go back to more than 5 or 10 years in terms of like the FANG stocks. But this does feel like there's now, we've entered a period where there's justifiable reason for other parts of the market, whether it's cyclical stocks in the U.S. or other markets around the world, to have this sort of day in the sun, and not just for a couple of weeks, but for an extended period of time. So kind of broadening, diversifying. Because ultimately, as you mentioned, I would agree that, what would actually get us in the rough, that 30% chance, there's a lot of different factors. Not one necessarily kind of jumps out to me, but, the best way to sort of manage that is through kind of being diversified. So, Torsten, thanks for your perspective. Really appreciate your insights. And I'm sure we'll be talking again fairly soon.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay. With that, Jason Torsten, always a rich and insightful conversation. Thank you again for joining us today on How Should I Be Positioned? And to you, our listeners, thank you as well for your engagement. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.